sorry. I will, from now on, I'll talk like this. I'll be talking about how I like cheeseburgers and I like Florida Man.
Oh, it sounds robotic. It sounds weirdly like sterile.
How dare you attack me for sounding robotic, Benji?
Welcome to Worldcasting, where we discuss real, made-up things. I'm your host, Tyler, and today I'm joined by Adam as we discuss worldbuilding with Tim Hickson from Hello Future Me and Benji Cook from Tales Foundry. If you gentlemen would be so kind as to give a little introduction about yourselves.
Well, as said, my name is Tim, and I run the YouTube channel Hello Future Me, which does a lot of things, but it does do videos on worldbuilding and writing in particular, discussing how those fit in with fiction and all that exciting stuff. I really love that. So thanks for having me here.
Thanks for coming on.
My name is Benji Cook. I run a YouTube channel called Tale Foundry. It's kind of a weird thing. It's hosted by a robot. There's some meta lore involved, but the crux of it is that we look at fiction, find what we love about it, and then put that to use in short stories we write for the show. And we kind of do this in mini series. So there'll be three video installments for each topic that we discuss, terminating in the end in this short story that we write. So that's kind of the theme or the format of the show.
That's so much more detailed and better.
I will admit that I actually have listened to more Tale Foundry than Hello Future Me. I did listen to your Magic series, which was, that one was really great.
Well, for Tim's sake, I'll say that I don't listen to as much Hello Future Me as I could, because every time I listen to something you've done, I feel totally like devastated by how good it is. I'm like, how can I match the depth of analysis you do on these things?
You have like in-channel lore. Like there is like lore behind the characters on your channel. That is like a depth I will never master. So you guys should go check out Tale Foundry. That's what you should do.
I also recommend Hello Future Me if you guys haven't heard of it. Great YouTube channel.
So getting right into it, you guys are both YouTubers who talk about world building, which is, you know, I guess kind of the entire reason for asking you on. And I do love both of your channels. And Adam, when he suggested this, was kind of like, oh, I'll ask Tim from Hello Future Me and we'll see if we get a response. And, you know, he'll come on. I'm like, okay. And thinking, you know, it'll be a couple days before I get a response. And like 10 minutes later, he's like, oh, I'm going to make a group chat for us. I'm like, oh, my God. And then, like, an hour into it, Tim goes, you know, I think Benji from Tale Founders would really like to do this. I'm like, oh, God, what the hell is going on? This spiraled out of control so fast. I'm just trying to watch Outlaw King.
I actually got a message from Tim, like, not 20, 25 minutes ago, where he's like, I didn't know you were going to be on today.
I thought I told you.
I thought you were going to have him on, like, another episode, like, in the future.
Oh!
So I was reading through like what we've got at the plan.
Cornucopia of pleasant surprises.
I was reading through the plan for what we're going to talk about. And there were questions like, so tell us about the lore behind the robot. I'm like, I don't know. Like, so I was like, oh no, they're going to be talking to me about that. But yeah, world building, that's fun. We love it. And there's just so much depth to it because it's basically talking about everything and anything there is in the world and how to do it kind of realistically and immersively, which is just so fun.
Yeah. Speaking about depth, it's interesting. I almost wouldn't consider myself like a world builder because the first thing I'm trying to do is write short stories for the most part. So world building is kind of something like I have to do as a part of the necessary process to create a setting for these stories. So it's like kind of a different angle. I realize like that's still totally legitimate world building. It's just like a different, more narrow angle on it, I guess.
No, I absolutely agree. I come from a similar angle. I see world building as a tool to facilitate a better story and sort of a necessary step to that. But I'm not a world builder first and foremost.
you see it as more of a utility. You take a more utilitarian approach to creating your worlds. So that way you can use it for something actively instead of like myself, who does it for fun.
Which
are both and totally legit.
Oh, most certainly. Most certainly.
Because I primarily write stories kind of like that are very character focused in this small scale ones. I don't usually have the scale that world building kind of like comes into it as a big part, you know, with huge cast of characters, epic fantasy, big magic systems. That's just not a big part of like what I am focusing on at the moment. But there is kind of that more subtle world building behind it, which I find really interesting to engage with and figure out the exact context in which my characters are kind of like living and their background.
You know, you say that, but yesterday you released a 30-minute video on world building monarchies, which was good. I saw that pop up and I immediately checked it out as someone who's working on a setting that exists within a couple of monarchies. That kind of thing is super interesting to me. So, it's just interesting to hear you talk about how it's a necessary evil, something that you enjoy, but not really the focus. And then, you know, some of your work involves these long videos.
So I should probably put a caveat on that in saying that even though like my personal work isn't world building focused, I find the study of world building in other people's work really interesting.
That's fair.
So that like world building as an exercise isn't just something that you do when you're creating, but it's a way that you engage with a work in like how you understand it and how you immerse yourself. So when I'm reading A Song of Ice and Fire, I'm not just engaging with it on a character level. I'm engaging with it on this is a really interesting economic system or political system or stuff like that. So I'm constantly thinking about it in a way that, you know, that I'm engaging with my enjoyment of the story comes from how good the world building is. So I study it in the texts and the films and the TV series that I like and love.
Yeah, I've kind of, especially since working with the World Building magazine these last couple years, I've begun to kind of understand it from a anthropological point of view almost, which I think is sort of similar to what you're talking about, where it's not just I need to world build and here's some cool things that I've thought of and I'm going to make them work. It's a lot of learning about how people in the real world work and applying that to the world that I'm creating, and how can we twist it in a new way? How can we mix cultures together or introduce something new that will surprise people and excite them?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally.
I'd also definitely agree with getting enjoyment from the dissection of the world building, because it just, I find that like looking at where people get their inspiration from and also what they've created with it, it's so interesting to just dive into it, and that's really where I get my enjoyment as well. So
I listened to The Lies of Locke Lamora recently, obviously a really compelling character-driven story. If you guys aren't familiar with it, it's basically about a band of orphan thieves who kind of take things over in their own way, and then have to deal with like a competing, better organized thief. And in this story, it's got this incredible lore kind of based on, as far as I know, Italian like architecture and history and things like that. And it's a totally secondary world fiction, but they don't focus on any of that in the story. Like the world building, you could kind of write the same story in a number of different worlds, but the world building, like what they did for it, the fact that there's like this elder glass that they use in construction, and there are remnants of this older, more advanced society, as you often see in these secondary world settings, all that stuff has this like it creates this depth. It makes you feel like you have lived in this different place for a while. It immerses you in a way that just following a compelling character arc might not have, you know. And I think like a story like this that has a transferable plot, I think is it makes a great case for the specificity of your world building and the impact that it'll have on the audience.
Yeah, I think I want to build on that point that you brought up about how it can immerse you in a way that character, well, that you know, character arcs, like in the absence of that, that character arcs may not. In particular with games, a lot of games, you know, you've got relatively empty characters because they're the person that the player slots into, but you can have these really fascinating worlds which have so much depth, often with that sort of, you know, past world thing that has long since fallen. So I totally see that the influence of what you're saying in games in particular.
You touched upon a really cool point with the idea of like the world feeling alive, because I think personally, and I've stated it a few times on the podcast, is that you have this belief a lot of world builders hold that you have to have this realistic world. And that's not really the case. It's a world that feels alive is the best ones. Those are the most immersive ones. One that you can go, this is genuine. Someone lives here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Damn, you stole my point. I was going to get into that later.
There's a YouTube video I really liked about this that I found a long time ago. I can't remember. I think it was Bobby the Tongue or Mr. B Tongue on YouTube. He talks about what he calls the shandification of Fallout, and he compares the original Fallout 3 to Fallout New Vegas. And there are settings in the original Fallout 3 where, like, Megaton, you'll go and visit it, and it'll be this cool thing, like a city based around the site of a nuclear impact, and they have a bomb at the center, and it's awesome and interesting. But then, like, at some point, the fridge logic kicks in, and there's something like nettling at the back of your mind, and you're like, wait a second, they don't have farms, like they don't produce food, they don't have a clear line of imports for food. Like, how are these people alive? Like, how is this a thriving town? And I'm not saying like you need every bathroom to be painted for a place to feel lived in, but then when he talks about New Vegas, they have like their hydroponic systems and stuff, and they're set up, and no one talks about them. I don't think, like, in the main quest arc, I don't think you're compelled to go visit them, but they exist there. They're seen to. And so I don't think this is like I said, the fact that you need to like show every bathroom that exists in every house to make sure that we all know that these are real people who can, you know, void their bowels. It's just that, like, there's that tickling sensation scratched at the back of your mind that you're like, okay, this is real. This is not just a bunch of props on a movie set.
Almost a subconscious thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I totally get you there.
And it's really interesting to kind of see that approach, like making the world just have like these little touches that make it breathe, that like having just the hydroponics, and it's not a big deal. It's not made a big deal. I think there's one miscellaneous quest attached to it that you have to find. So it's, mm-hmm. It really is interesting to see that approach versus, you're right, like in Vault 3 of Megaton and Tenpenny Tower and Rivet City, and none of them have a source of water or food, and it's like, how are they around?
Yeah, and right. this is weird, because like a open world game where you can explore has something intrinsically different about it than a piece of literature, where it's like, this is kind of countering something I said earlier, but like, if I'm invested in a character arc, and like, there's a lot of setting around the character and stuff, I'm not necessarily looking for the hydroponics, but if you mention it, if you show me that there's something different about this world, or there's something that makes it feasible, that makes it work, that will sink me deeper into this setting. I don't think I would have thought about missing it, but it's like you said, Tim, it's totally subconscious. I think it just contributes something to have that depth, rather than it being like a compulsory thing you need to add to your world.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think a lot of world building is about how much you sort of answer questions before they ever rise up in the reader's mind, you know, so that there's this sense that as they're traveling through it, whether it be in a book or a game, that it makes sense on just a very fundamental level before ever kind of challenges immersion, you know. And I want to touch on, or should we touch on this now, or should we touch on this later, about realistic world building and whether that's good?
No, please bring it up.
Okay, so this is a bit of a gripe, and I've got a video in the works about it, but world building circles have a huge emphasis on realism. they have a huge emphasis on transliterating things from our world into fictional worlds. Now, it might just be taking parts of our history or whatever and mixing them together, but we have a huge emphasis on basically following the logic of realism. That's got to be realistic. But as you sort of alluded to before, good world building doesn't mean realistic world building. It just means immersive world building. And I think that the best testament to this is Studio Ghibli films. They're you know, like, all of those are pretty unrealistic worlds. Like, they aren't hugely reliant on like logical realism. They have an internal consistency to them, but I think it'd be a mistake to describe their world building as good because it's logical. I think it's good because it's immersive and consistent and interesting.
Definitely. When you see something like Spirited Away, you're drawn into this little hidden world of magic, and like, they turn people into pigs, and there's all this crazy magical stuff going on with the polluted river spirit and No Face, and you're grabbed in, and not once do you think, oh, where's he getting the gold from, or like, is he like matter transmuting like the gold? No, he has gold. No, you don't obsess. And it's so easy to get trapped. It's so easy to fall into this like desire to make everything follow logic and
rationalize line. It.
Yes, exactly. To rationalize what you want.
I don't have a strong basis for this. The only basis for it is my experience as a writer, but I kind of think a lot of that is fueled by a fear of being caught out. Like, you see these people discussing world building and discussing what authors do right and stuff, and how like, oh, this author knew about like mountain shadows, so they know how a mountain range would affect storm patterns and stuff like that. And like, that's really impressive to know that author knew that. And as a new writer, you go like, I had no idea. I don't know any of this stuff. I guess I have to learn it first. And that eventually, I think, translates, like, as you get into communities and stuff, into a form of criticism where you go like, well, you're not doing this thing. You're not making sure you know about all this stuff. And yeah, after a fashion, I think it is. It's definitely elitism at the very least.
Oh, yeah. Also, like, I too did not understand the connection between mountain shadows and storm patterns.
Until just now, were you saying? Or like before you looked into it?
No, I did not understand.
The idea of hot and cold and dry and wet wind and all these other things. And I'm sorry, you've not taken a natural disasters or a geography course. No, it's how dare you get into this without, you know, getting your college degree in world building related topics. And
and this is tricky, though, because like, we're not here to lambaste anyone who like loves that stuff and loves the act of like world building and figuring out all these things and rationalizing. Like, if that's fun for you, do it. But the other ugly side of this is what Tim was talking about, where it's like, if I write a story and, you know, storm patterns and stuff aren't important, and I just happen to have people on a mountain range on the other side of the desert, and it's also desert over there, and there's not like this effect where like the clouds build up and there's extra moisture, and if I don't think about that scrubland being more lush, please don't have it out for me. Like, I hope the rest of the story is still good enough to be worth your time, even though I didn't think of that, you know?
Yeah, of course. You want to have this approach to it where you want your product to be good, and so you worry about what people who know this stuff will think. And I think in the end, it's coming to this middle ground where you're not going to know everything, and yet you still have this what's the best way to put it? Like, this fear, I guess. And I have it too, and I've studied this stuff, and I love this stuff, and it's like, wait, is this right? Or sometimes you have to scrap the rules. Is it enough? And the answer is, it's never enough, because you could dedicate a lifetime. You could dedicate a lifetime to trying to perfectly create wind and sea patterns and all these other things for your world, and it'll never be as accurate as it could.
The world building community loves linguistics. Like, they love creating fictional languages, which is, of course, rooted in Tolkien's love for it being the grandfather of kind of modern fantasy genre world building as it is, like the way that he did it. But like I, you know, place like linguistics for me has just never been a focus by world building. That's just not been something. Conlangs are just not my, not the area of my interest necessarily.
I tried once long ago.
Yeah, I think sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think that's like a, almost a rite of passage at some point to like sit down and be like, oh, I'm going to come up with this language for this race or this country or whatever in a fictional work. And like, I know somewhere in this room, there's a spiral notebook with like 3 pages of like really, really bad, basic level, like linguistics jerry rigging, I would say.
And then if you're really young and you turn 11 and then you realize, like, other languages don't just have one-for-one translations for words. Like, that's not how languages work. And as you're a kid, you're just like, oh my gosh, how do languages work then? Oh, well, they work, you know, they put in different orders. So you just put the words in a different order and it still doesn't make sense.
But can I just use apostrophes and like, hyphens? Yeah. Oh, I found m-dash. That's a completely different thing.
Yeah, we've talked about this a couple of times here on the podcast. I remember, I think it was our 3rd episode from the last season. We spoke specifically about names for places, which always kind of bother me because so often we see people, you know, coming to the Discord or asking questions just in general, like, what should I name these places? You know, I don't know what to name them. It's a very stressful thing for a lot of people. Which, you know, ties back into conlanging and how do we form all these different sounds and make it sound unique, sound like we're not copying Tolkien or whatever. And, you know, my answer to that kind of thing is just always back to, I'm going to go back to that episode of the podcast real quick. One of our people on the magazine, Anna, she told a story about this place near where she lives, where this guy couldn't get across the water at this cape. And so they called it Cape Disappointment. And I might be butchering part of that story, but they called it Cape Disappointment basically because they couldn't get across it the first time and it stuck. And now there's just a place called Cape Disappointment. And there's a whole bunch of other ridiculous names out there, even ones that we hear all the time, like Rocky Mountains. That's very boring. So, like, people stress over what to call the places in their world, the towns, the physical geographic locations, whatever it may be, which it just doesn't need to be something we need to stress over because the people who are naming those things are just pointing at a thing and being like, I'm going to name that after my dad, or I'm going to name it after what it looks like. And, you know, that's pretty much it.
And it's interesting, like, if you think about what happens with these names after a long period of time, as the place becomes more significant, we don't go like, okay, that name was stupid. Let's change it retroactively. I mean, sometimes maybe, but like, think about names like the Grand Tetons, like, okay, those are the boob mountains, like, but it's still significant. It's still a beautiful place you'd want to visit. And when you think of the Grand Tetons, you don't think of that ridiculous reason for naming it. You think of the mountain itself and what it means and your experience visiting it. And
yeah, it just becomes more grandiose in your head when you hear it.
Mm-hmm. I can just imagine Stalin sitting in a room going, Leningrad? Yeah, what? What about it? I want to change. What? Gone. Just like really petty.
It pretty much was.
Oh, I removed him from all the photos. We broke up.
So I guess that does happen, but yeah, case in point, it's kind of weird when it does. Like,
yeah, it's weird. It's the exception. Yeah. Like we have kind of this, like, one of the things I touched on in my video on place names was sort of cultural initiatives to actually change the names. And in particular, like from the New Zealand experience, there's a big movement from the 1990s to try and reintroduce indigenous names into cities. So like all of the towns, you know, have like their Māori name and their English name next to one another. And also they're trying to encourage the use of indigenous names for particular places, which is kind of like it's sort of like a driven, deliberate attempt to change the names in a way, which is an interesting example in the modern context.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And like it's kind of the opposite of what we were talking about, because we were saying like sometimes the name of a place is just a matter of happenstance, but then like you have, I mean, I think you can even tie that to what you were talking about like someone just pettily wanting to rename a place. Like there's one thing that happens when like you come across a place, you impulsively have to come up with a word to describe it or whatever. But then later on, if you find something of more significance, it's not like that name's stupid, let's replace it. Sometimes there is like a good, just reason to want to append a new title to something. Or, you know, like you said, a petty, weird reason. But I guess like what I would say for the whole conversation, what I'm like kind of learning by talking about this is that like place names aren't given to places in general because there's foresight about what they will mean to the world. They're given to places for very different reasons, reasons that are very personal to the people at the time, like Cape Disappointment, or I don't know if the Grand Tetons is just a joke, but like someone, they had to have a word for it at the time, and that like pressure to come up with something is significant, you know.
Well, they typically the names arise from like whatever the importance of the place is. So if it's the one place where they get fresh water, then the name will usually be something to do with the purpose that place serves. You know, like that'll be one of the origins, and then it'll evolve as the language evolves, and then we get this one which has an ancient meaning associated with that, but doesn't necessarily mean that for us today.
Yeah, I think on a similar note, Tim, misinterpretations of places and the names that they have are a big factor as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, no, definitely. We have a bunch of mountains in New Zealand which are called mountain because they'll be called Mount and then the Māori name for mountain.
Solid.
Yeah,
that's fascinating. I love that. Yeah. I think
that's what River Raven means. It means river.
That's fabulous. That's the kind of thing that's so like weirdly circumstantial and organic that it's just hard to think to come up with it as a world builder, you know. And like pointing to things like this is really helpful to people who are intrepid about or like worried about the process, because it's like if you want an organic world, do some weird stuff, do some basics. Yeah,
come up with stupid names.
Yeah,
that's it's because there was a Germanic population who came over I think it was the Saxons, came over to Britain, and I can't remember the name of the people who were already living there at the time, off the top of my head, but basically,
Britons.
Sure, yep, and they said, oh, this is the Avon, and they go, oh, that's a river, that's the River Avon. No, that's just the Avon. Okay, we're going to call it River. It's just that they didn't understand what that meant, so that's how it came about.
I wonder if there's a way to like begin to become more aware of this kind of organic thing and like incorporate it into your world building, because it's hard to get away from the authorial conceit when you're building a world. It doesn't feel like a world to you. It feels like a construct in your mind. Like you're aware of what you want it to be and the effect you want it to be want it to have on the audience. And if you want it to be like a grand, sprawling, epic fantasy thing, naming something River, it makes it more realistic, but not. It doesn't really contribute to your effort to like convey that grand, epic experience. You know. So, as much as that's an awesome, interesting thing, I think there are like two sides of it. Learning how to do it would be fascinating. And I would love to see someone like develop a fantasy world where, and I'm sure people have done this already, but develop a fantasy world that have more rivers and have more mountains and have more boob named mountains, etc. But, you know, on the other side, I can also really respect the fact that if there's something you want to achieve with world building, ultimately it is a tool, and you're totally within your rights to want to be as fantastic as you can be and not name all those mundane things. But it's tricky because like, I think the other thing people end up getting really afraid of, aside from just seeing other authors successfully achieve these effects, is they're intimidated by their own authorial conceit, the thing they want to make, and they don't know how to get there. And so they're like, I want this to be this grand epic fantasy thing, but I can't think of any names that are epic enough for this town or this mountain or something like that. And it's a really difficult thing. I think it's probably paralyzing for a lot of authors. I wish I could cap that off with something hopeful, but like I don't actually completely know how to address this.
Here's the problem. I will not do it.
Good luck.
If you have an answer, solution, email me.
Please.
One thing I will say is I think that as you begin naming things, if you do have this massive epic world, you can probably hopefully name a couple of things. But then as you run out of names and you have more things to title, at that point, you can just start calling things River River. Because you know what? That's what happened in reality. So why not? So you know, maybe you can use that as an out to name a few extra things that you wouldn't have otherwise thought of.
My favorite post I think I've seen on Reddit was this one where someone posted a slightly altered upside down one of Europe, and you know if you look at it for a little more than 30 seconds, you'll figure out what it is. But you know, to the people who they go, oh, can you critique my world map? And then you know, like you get these people critiquing the map of Norway.
Isn't that literally what Westeros is? Like, isn't it just like Britain flipped and rotated?
Yeah. There's a little bit of that. I'm so sorry. We've seemed to have derailed this into place names, where it seemed to be like how to get started on world building.
I don't know what you're talking about. This is the place names episode.
This is legitimately what happened the whole time.
I mean, I don't have that much to say about place names in general, but the reason this conversation is interesting to me is from the psychological perspective of new writers. Place names, like you opened by saying, it's really intimidating for them. And a lot of the conversation we've been having so far is in part saying, like, it's okay to be a little lower key about some of the names in your world. And on the other hand, it's also like, I understand that you want something to be grandiose and epic and stuff, but I mean, maybe that's hard for everybody. Maybe you can't just start there with these like amazing, perfect encapsulations of the effect you want to create in your audience.
Yeah. And you got to remember. Yeah. And I think you've also got to remember that two of the most famous locations in the most famously world-built story ever are the Shire and Mount Doom.
There you go. That's fabulous. Yeah.
And the Shire sounds interesting to us, but it is just the Shire. Like,
that's a place name, like yeah, that's an eponym for England, and so.
yeah, and like I've got a secondary world I'm working on right now for a D&D campaign where like the setting is called The Machine. There are characters in it just named like there's a robot named Proctor, Rector, Praetor, and like for them, for the robots, it's okay because they're not humans and that's not weird. But like they're also super basic names that just describe exactly what they are and what their function is, but for the effect of the story, it's just fine. Like, we didn't need anything extra. We didn't need it to be very hard SF. We just wanted it to be easily identifiable and like immersive or just quaint in a way, because this is a D&D campaign where we're like zany robots in world, robot world, you know?
And I mean, just to take that from a storytelling perspective, you look at one of the more famous pieces of English literature, the Canterbury Tales, and that's exactly what they are. They're each telling, they're each just a name, a title, and they're telling a tale that you can kind of understand why through their name. And it works. There's nothing more to it. You don't need to know more. And I think that we get this idea handed down to us, even if we haven't read them, that yeah, sometimes you can just name someone by their title so long as it fits the basic concept of it. All right. So, Benji and Tim, we had just a couple of general questions about your work that we wanted to bring up. First of all, just if you guys have a second, just a quick how you got started would be really appreciated.
It was a long, traumatic process, honestly. Like, I'd like to say I just had a flare of inspiration and like got to work, but no, like it wasn't like that. I spent about 6 years in college not getting a degree and not knowing what I wanted to do. And the long or the short of that is I ended up without a degree and without real practical knowledge. I homeschooled for like 2 years before that, went to a community college for a little while, and came out on the other end with very little to show for the experience, other than some orientation. But I ended up in a nursing program, wasn't working out. I am a hypochondriac, so that was a big deal breaker. But in the meantime, while I was doing all of this, the thing that I was doing that was really effective for me was I was cultivating my interests. I was learning how to use the Adobe Creative Suite for my own projects. I was learning how to write. I had these various stints where I was like, oh, I'm going to be a game designer. No, I don't like coding. Well, I want to tell stories anyway. I'm going to be a novelist. No, it's not rewarding enough and it's isolating and it's difficult for me. I need some kind of feedback and it's very hard to share a novel you're working on. So I worked on all this stuff, and eventually after leaving the nursing program, I was like, I gotta do something. I gotta do something I'll care about. And how can I take my passions and turn them into something marketable, a product that people can like use and has value to them? And I realized if I'm making art for my own sake and not thinking about people consuming it, that can work for some people, but I think that's rare. I think it's difficult just to make something you love and depend on other people picking it up. Can work out, but very hard to sell a lot of the time. So if you can find something you're passionate about that you love doing that also has value for the people on the other end, then you have maybe a more likely end game plan, a more likely trajectory. So that's what Tale Foundry ended up being. All this stuff that I loved, writing, video editing, a lot of the graphic stuff I learned from game design came together to create Tale Foundry. And the idea for Tale Foundry... Thank you. I kind of sometimes I wish they were less because, man, they take a long time to make. I'm envious of people who can make content a little more swiftly than I can. But and that's what the live streams are for. I've finally got weekly content. But yeah, so that's the kind of the long version of it. The short version that I would tell someone if we were on like a 5-minute time frame is that I went through this long period of time and felt like there was nothing for me as a writer. Like anything I could find on YouTube at the time and like BookTube and stuff, like a lot of it was either stuff people were working on and blogging about or stuff people had consumed and wanted to talk about. But there was very little stuff that talked about like me in the position I was in, not knowing how to write or not knowing how to make a novel and wanting to. And I wished there was something high production that did that. And so I kind of just filled that niche that I wished existed. And that's what Tale Foundry essentially is. Every series is essentially the development of a short story, finding something that's worth writing about, and then writing about it and sharing the process. And that's one of the reasons the brand has become so intimate. It was hard at the beginning, but I've kind of had to learn that it's like 90% of what I do is being honest about the fact that I don't really know what I'm doing. And the fact that I can share that with people seems to be galvanizing for them.
Yeah, for sure. It's always nice to have, you know, someone telling you that, you know, this feeling that you have of not really knowing if you're doing the right thing or not feeling you know enough, etc., that other people feel that too. It's something that I think we forget very often, is that other people go through the same stuff that we do very often. So, yeah, I mean, it's awesome that you can use your platform to remind people of that and make them feel comfortable and stuff. Now, one thing I did want to ask, just a quick question for you. You kind of touched on the level of detail and character that you put into your videos. You've got the little robot in your your videos. Just kind of curious where that came from.
Yeah, that's weird. I actually have the original sketch that turned into Tailbot hanging on my wall right now. And I can see it. And it's actually on a page of The Return of the King by Tolkien, which awesome. Is like sacrilege to some people. But I believe in destroying books. I think that's what they're for, being well loved. So I've got that. And it was just that I liked... Like as an artist, I liked the way it felt to draw machines, these rigid shapes and stuff, and shading them in the metal. And I just liked the aesthetics of it. And so I played with it a lot as a developing artist. And then by the time I was making Tale Foundry, I already had like all these designs and stuff. And I needed to have something because I wanted to have a host for the show that wasn't me, because I didn't want the show to be about Benji at the time. I wanted it to be about the writing. So I kind of separated myself with a host. And because I already had this design and stuff, it all just kind of clicked. And then I needed the tailoids, the little robots. And I was like, well, I need something simple because Tailbot's complex. He can only be on the screen for so long. I need something I can do in a variety of different poses. So that's how aesthetically, Tailbot and the Tailoids were created for the show. The Metalore thing, I think, is probably a longer question. So I'll let us like move on for now, and we can circle back around to it if we want to in the future.
Just a quick follow up as well. You said at the time you didn't want to really be associated with the show. You wanted that distance. Would you change that now that you've been doing it for so long?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there was a really awkward period where I kayfabed real hard, and like I would make social media posts as Tailbot, and like on my Discord server, I had a separate account for Tailbot and Benji, and I would like have two computers open and have conversations with myself and stuff for the fans. And it was like, it was weird and awful. And like, I realized very quickly, I was never going to be able to develop a relationship with my community if I was trying to keep this facade up. So I made a rule pretty early on, within like the first year and a half, where I said, like, the lore is on the channel, not anywhere else. The lore is in the main show. Everything else is reality. And the reason for that, I think it's important that I separate myself in the show, is so that like it doesn't become a personality driven show, so that it can be just about creativity and like making stuff up, as the slogan goes for the show. And I worry, like, if it was too much about Benji and not Tailbot, there would be that kind of level of, I don't know, like idolization. It's weird to say about yourself, but I've never been a fan of that in shows, and I just didn't want to be a factor in the show I was making.
No, that's understandable.
I love the fact that it's like almost like this anonymous persona that kind of puts forward all this, and it makes it more relatable almost, because it's like a stand-in. Like it's someone's work, but it's not the character's, because the character is just the stand-in for it. So it makes it easier to see the work for what it is, and it makes it more about the writing.
Yeah, I didn't actually know all of this. I didn't know these were my reasons for doing it when I started. A lot of it was impulsive, and sometimes that's just the way things turn out in the end. But yeah, looking back, that's definitely like the intrinsic reason I was going for that. And I'm glad the effect worked out. You know, sometimes like there is some stuff you can kind of bank on if precedents exist. If there's a niche, if there's something people clearly want, and you have the skills to fill it, you can kind of count on people coming to bite the line you threw out. But there's other stuff, like if you're going to use an animated fictitious robot to narrate everything, will people like that? Will they identify with it? I don't know what else you could look to for that, for a precedent. So sometimes you just gotta, like, if it feels right, go for it, I guess.
All right, Tim. So Benji gave us a little bit of background on himself about how he got started. Now, spill your secrets. It's your turn.
Okay, so mine was by complete accident. Basically, I tried for like 6 months doing these really, really unfunny skits, which are on my channel still, and people technically can find them, but I hope they never do. Where I would try and be funny, which doesn't work. And none of them went anywhere, you know. I did no idea. So after 6 months, I was like, I'll give up. But in my last month, I tried like a few different types of video, and my last one was like a fandom, a lore one, like a theory. You know, those fan theories that are out on YouTube about everything.
It's a fan theory.
It's a fan theory. 6 months after that, it exploded to 250,000 views, and I was like, oh, better capitalize on this. And so I started doing a lot more of that kind of fandom content, and then I added Avatar, and then I added Lord of the Rings, and then which is where we're getting to now. The big thing for me is writing and world building. When I found that, I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. This is how I make what I do meaningful. This is how I feel fulfilled. And I added those in. And the root of that was that I was looking on YouTube, and I was going, okay, I want to see accessible educational content, because at the time I was at university, and I've got an arts degree. I did English, and that education was terrible. Like, they were teaching stuff in that class that I knew in year 10. And so I was like, okay, I want to find accessible, good quality content that isn't just kind of like too broad to be helpful, or so specific that... too broad to be helpful, or like super restrictive and specific. And that was what I was finding on YouTube. I was finding these kind of like two extremes of kind of like broad rules, which don't really help, you know, like write a first chapter, Okay, great. How should you do it? You should introduce your main character. Right. What does that mean? Okay, I want to go in more depth on this. So basically, I started making the writing content that I wanted to see, with a heavy emphasis on not what you should do, but what you could do, and just kind of offering these as suggestions to work with. And that's really how I got to where I am. That's where I, what really defined my channel and how I define my job now.
Man, there's something in the like humility of not knowing what you wanted to do when you started YouTube that like kind of makes my inner like younger 22-year-old self squirm with pretense, where I was like, I'm gonna make a YouTube show that, and it's gonna work. It's got to.
I tried like a bazillion different things. Like and this is also outside of YouTube. Like I've tried, you know, running a business. I tried to start a jewelry business at one point and that did not work. You know, and this was just same. The one that worked in the end.
Wait, did you say you same?
Yeah. It was really
what a crossover.
Yeah, it's so weird. It's like Tim and I, heads up, this is the second time we've ever talked verbally. The first time was on his 24-hour charity stream. So like we're just getting to know each other through live events. But I was really into like crafting and stuff, and I thought making necklaces with findings and like turning found gears and stuff shockingly into jewelry was fun. And I started to think like, how many of these would I need to make and sell at a rate of $5 a piece a day to make a living? And like I would think about that all the time.
Yeah, but I take it didn't work out for you in the end, like for me.
No, mostly because I was lazy.
So yeah, that's pretty much how my channel got started, and then where it evolved to now. And you know, it's still evolving as it is, but you know, the writing world building is where the heart of my work is at.
You say it's still evolving. Where do you think the next step is?
People don't like change. So when you say I'm moving away from certain types of content, they go, "What?" And if you really sneak, do it without them noticing, and then they don't get too annoyed. But if you say it explicitly, then they go, no, we need those videos. No, don't do that. But basically, I used to do a lot of lore and theories, and I did other shows and movie series. But I'm moving away from a couple of those. Like I basically stopped doing How to Train Your Dragon videos. In fact, I stopped doing that like almost a year ago. Fandom content is like theories and lore, you know, things just as simple as who is Harry Potter's, what's his deepest fear, and then you talk about that. It's just not particularly in depth, and I've found that there are a lot of other YouTubers doing that sort of content where they talk about these sort of fandoms and just the lore around it, and I was like, okay, I want to be doing something that other people doing. So even when it comes to Avatar The Last Airbender, which is a big part of my channel, I'm not really doing lore or theories about it anymore because everyone else is going to be doing that, especially with the live action TV series coming out. So I'm always trying to make content that only I can make. I think that's kind of a bottom line for me. I don't know if you feel about that, Benji. Like, do you feel like you kind of want to make content that only you can make?
Oh yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think there's a need in a lot of people, or at least a desire, when they consume something they love, they really want more of it, like desperately. And I always wondered, like, there are all these commentators, like a Game of Thrones season will come out, and there's people who come on and just like do a review of the episode. And I've never really been that interested in that content, and I've always wondered, like, why are people? And I think the answer is just because, like, it keeps them seated in that thing that they love. It keeps them engaged in it. And I think for some people, like, that's a valuable thing. But there's also, like, for people like you and me, there's a point at which, as a creator, it kind of stops giving back, where you stop feeling like your need as a fan becomes sated, and you're like, am I doing anything? Like, am I making anything, or am I just giving you more pseudo content for that thing that exists already?
That's a really interesting way to phrase it, and I totally get what you mean. It sort of started to feel like I wasn't providing anything of value. either for me or that's something they can't get somewhere else. And that's sort of the trajectory going forward with my channel, is that I'm potentially both moving away from some of the topics that I've stuck to in the past, which is also a method of not getting stuck with an audience that can't change, which is a trap that a lot of channels fall into. And also just expanding, you know, my ability to my kind of capacity to commentate on writing and world building in other stories and films and TV and books that I like, and not just be restricted to those topics. So yeah, that's kind of where my channel's evolving in the future.
It's really interesting to hear you guys talk about that, because, you know, at the root of all your answers, it's partly about, you know, your satisfaction with what you're creating and trying to make something, you know, special. But at the heart of it all is also just so much influence through marketing, and how are you going to sell what you're doing to people so that they tune in to watch it and tune in to watch the next thing. And I know, like, as well, you guys are both on Patreon, and how do I bring people to that, like, through my content? So it's just, it's very interesting to hear you guys talk about, and for me to hear, because I did do, had work in marketing and advertising for a few years. That's part of what I'm getting from your answers as well.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of questions about identity that you kind of got to figure out when you're creating a brand. Like, I used to make a lot of videos, or some videos, about mythology. It's kind of where I started with one of my early series.
That's how I found you. I found you with your Celtic mythology stuff.
Yeah, and like, when you watch those videos, I'll be the first to admit there's a weird dissonance, because there's something I want to do with the show that's very important that I talked about earlier, which is finding something that works in a literary sense in a piece of fiction, and then transplanting it into a work that I've made, showing that, like, there are transferable things that make stories or content work. And with mythology, usually that comes down to content. Usually it's not like there's a particular literary device or something in play that we want to take and use in a new story. And if there is, usually that's more of a question of, like, history or anthropology or something like that. What were people doing at the time with their literature? Not really stuff that I'm trying to learn from and transfer. So it's been difficult to figure out what to do with mythology. And I realized, like, it's kind of, for my purposes, it's a difficult well to plumb, because there are some literary paradigms I can pull out of mythology, but then I don't talk about all the stories that make the mythology matter and all the characters and stuff. And there's other channels. Like, if you really want good mythology synopses and evaluation, go watch Overly Sarcastic Productions. They do it better than I ever could. And seeing that niche is kind of filled expertly and stuff, there's something else I'm trying to achieve with my brand. And so I've kind of had to move away from that, even though my mythology videos were relatively, like, successful. So it is kind of like a weird, painful thing. And I do constantly get people in my comments being like, oh, when are you going to do your next mythology video, whatever. But since it's been such a long time at this point, since I've done a strict mythology video, I also have this new fresh crop of people who don't expect that at all.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, there's that really interesting relationship. And I don't want to go too, like, the complexities of the YouTube audience relationship and how that affects you personally and how that affects your work, because we're not here to talk about that. but, like, there is sort of that constant push and pull of, you know, who does your content belong to in a sense, you know, mixed with the practical realities of you needing to make content that whatever you're doing, fit the job that you're trying to do on YouTube to actually earn money and stay afloat, and doing what you really want to do. And when you get trapped in a spiral where you can only make content that is, you know, for an audience so that you can keep going, I feel like that's just going to end up in collapse. That's going to end up in burnout.
Yeah, it's definitely a different kind of take than, you know, we're used to here at Worldcasting and Worldbuilding Magazine, because all of us are doing it kind of on the side. We all have other jobs that we take care of and then come here and do this for fun, and work on something to put out whenever it's ready. But then for you guys, like, this is a job for you. So it's definitely like you have to take those things into consideration.
I will state, though, just as a quick aside, because you'd mentioned stopping to do the mythology videos because of other channels doing them. And one thing that I like about both of you guys, actually, is the way you present your information, but it's more so how you orate it. I find people like Extra Credits and Overly Sarcastic tend to be too fast. Like watching Matt Colville for D&D, it's so fast, it's not good oration, because yes, you're cramming as much information as you can in as much little time as possible, but in the end, how are you really going to pay attention to everyone when they're talking this fast? It's not conducive to learning.
That's a really interesting thought. That's not something that's... I've actually felt the opposite, where like Tailbot has a cadence. He has a voice, and I'm not going to change that. It wouldn't feel right. But I get a lot of comments, or not a lot, but like every once in a while, I'll have someone comment and be like, oh, I had to watch this video at 2x speed or whatever, and then it works out. But it's weird. Like, you don't always hear from the people who appreciate what you're doing, because to them, if it's working, it's kind of invisible, right? Like, they don't have something to talk about because they were satisfied.
I actually had a conversation once about one of your, I believe it was one of your Slavic videos, not Slavic, the Celtic videos. And it was just me and my friend discussing how someone else had talked about it recently, and like just slowing it down and actually speaking about it, you could understand what was going on and follow it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I will say as well, like both of your guys' videos, actually the other day, I was doing the dishes and put on Tim's new video about monarchies. And it was something that I was very easily able to just kind of have on in the background. And, you know, the screen was off to the side so I could look at it, but it wasn't really my focus. And, you know, I still learned from it. I still got the content. And I think if it was presented in a different way, like you're talking about, with an orator that was speaking quickly to, you know, get through things, faster for, you know, this hypothetical YouTube audience that needs to consume content quickly. That's just not really me. I don't mind a half hour long video, because I'm probably going to just have it on in the background while I get something else done. So yeah, definitely in agreement with Dino here, that this is something that is appealing to me about the videos you guys make.
I do have another thought, but Tim, if there's anything else you want to weigh in with here, I feel like I've been doing a lot of talking, so totally feel free to interrupt me at any time. But I kind of think this is a hard thing to talk about, because I don't want to like presume anything or step on anyone's toes, but I've felt this before as a creator. And as a creator, there's this pretense that comes with it that like you might not even want. It's just part of it, where like you're standing on a stage in front of a bunch of people and they're looking to you, and like they expect you, if you're willing to stand on the stage, to be confident, and to be confident for a reason. And so if you're presenting information, it's like you better make sure it's like valid, that like it's got like high veracity, and like you better deliver it in a way that conveys that you feel these things. And I think the pace thing is mostly about like the faster you can talk about something, the more confident you are about the topic. You're not speaking circuitously or like stopping to think. You're just like
I'm just so that you can use that word in a conversation.
Well, to be fair, I learned it from Magic the Gathering, 50% of my vocabulary. But nice. Yeah, I think there is like a reason some people will like speed up their audio or try to talk as quickly as possible. And I don't think necessarily it's that they're trying to con people into thinking they're more confident than they are or smarter than they are or something like that. I think it might just be because there's that like pretense to fill that you are that way. Like, even if you don't intend to make anyone think that, it's a thing you kind of, as a creator, feel compelled to do sometimes.
I firmly believe that just confidently displaying your information and feeling like, yes, this is what I'm talking about, it's just good oration. And good oration is something you can either feel with, it's something you can learn with, or it's something you can believe in. And each one has its own uses. And in the end, it's trying to find which one you want your your oration to be used for. And in this case, it's learning.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I don't know what it's like to be a channel centered on expository content, because a lot of the content I do is like, this is literature and I'm giving you a perspective on how it works. This is all speculative. And it, like, I've thought very deeply about this and I'm just trying to like have that conversation. Where if you're doing an expository channel, there might be more pressure to like come off as confident, to come off as if you really know what you're on about. So that might be something that contributes to kind of that like fast clip trend. Might be the reason people used to do jump cuts so much in their live videos. But yeah, that's kind of my take on why.
Well, it is definitely. It's that idea that you cannot let them disengage for a second. And but of course, like, I don't know. I don't know. Speaking more slowly makes you feel like you've thought about it more to me. Just on like it's sort of like an optics, just from an optics perspective.
And not to mention that you can keep someone engaged no matter the pace at which you speak. It's just hooking them into it.
You just have to speak to them in a good voice.
Okay, Palpatine. this is weird to bring up. I did not think I'd be talking about this, but I was Mormon for like 18 years or something like that. And they do this thing.
I did not think you'd be talking about this. Yeah,
well, it is a world building episode. I'm sure there's interesting precedents, but the
world building of Joseph Smith.
It's definitely not the first time someone's admitted to being part of the LDS on stream. So,
oh my God. It sounds so like shame. Someone's admitted to it. No, but like, but okay. There's this thing they have. I have a lot of family that's Mormon. So like all love to like the people in the church, you know, I'm not here to like rag on it, but like, there's this thing they have called General Conference where they kind of convene, digitally across basically a big live stream with the authorities of the church. And they kind of like, there's this verbal coaching thing you learn when you're in the church, because you are compelled to give talks like you see them do during General Conference. And you can see it in all of these leaders of the church who, instead of talking like this, they'll talk in this sonorous, slow clip. When they give their presentations, it's like, I have this feeling about this topic, and I wanted to share it with all of you because of this. And they speak lowly, and like, I remember waking up on Saturday mornings with it playing throughout the house and like having goosebumps at like the sibilance in the consonant sounds as they spoke. And it's just like hypnotic. And I'm not like, again, that's not a dig. It's actually like really interesting how effective that kind of slow, like direct speech is, that slow, like
it's the
intentionally slow speech.
It's that sonorous tone where you have
this deep meaning and you drop the pitch of your voice and you want people to pay attention to every syllable.
Yeah, it's like sexy.
We should have the audio editor just continuously drop the bass on Tyler's speech during that section.
Let's return to world building.
Fine.
We can do this on our weekly more chat next time, you know.
There we go.
So,
no, but thanks for sharing. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, it very, very much was. So I guess we'll just jump into a next topic. And I'm really curious about this because I have no fans and everyone hates my podcast. So when you guys have met
your fans. Fans. Hey,
I feel invalidated right now.
You both are very active with your communities. I mean, Benji, you went to the lengths of, you know, having a Tailbot account, and Tim, I see you constantly on social media. So it's...
That sounds like a criticism.
I can't stop. No, it's weird. It's like I'm not. I'm constantly interacting with fans, but I have no idea how to do Twitter. I have no idea.
You just post all of your terrible takes on there, and then you get lots of likes and retweets, and then it escalates from there.
Alien to me, completely.
Like, I intend to tweet out that you shouldn't have lemon on fish, and everyone apparently disagrees with me.
That's I see you tweet about that, and I'm like, how did he think to tweet about that? Like, if I could just even have the thought, like, because I would never, and it's not like a humility thing. It's just that, like, I don't care enough, and like, why would I ever expect somebody else to? And like, not a dig, they obviously do, because they engage with it and stuff. And I wish I had that. Like, I wish I had that just, like, interest in talking about whatever is happening in my life. But, okay, Dino, you were asking a question, or Dino, Tyler, you were asking a question, I believe.
It's just, how do you guys go about it? No, you actually asked it for, like, how do you guys formulate this, like, to really try to reach out and find the niche that you want to fill, and like, hey, this is where they communicate with me, and this is how I want to communicate with them, and it's this astral alignment, and Jupiter's it waxing, and you're like, oh, look, I just, like, why would you put lemon on fish? And everyone responds to it, and it's, you know, it's
pure magic.
It's pure magic. It's amazing. It's like, almost, I wish I could world build a character that clever, because I don't think I ever would think to just ask questions on Twitter. I have a Twitter account, like, and I've posted once. So,
but like, Tim, to you, when you posted that, you were like, oh yeah, this is like ingenious. Like,
actually, no, to be honest, like, half the time those nonsense things come out because I'm in, like, a conversation with a friend or my girlfriend, and she goes, no, you're wrong. And I go, I'll prove you wrong.
There you go.
Yeah. But, so what's your question? Is it how to build an audience online? Is that what you're asking?
Just, how have you guys, like, gone about interacting with them? Like, how did you formulate your, I guess, plan to do it?
I don't have a plan. I gotta be honest. Like, I just sort of, I mean, when I think about how I sort of interact with fans and do that sort of thing, part of it is that being personable in my job is a requirement for success, in a sense. You know, like, that sort of social relationship is there. And you do have to work with that a lot of the time, whether you really want to or not. I just try and post stuff that people will be interested in. I guess I'm sorry, but I really don't have like a strong strategy there. It's not something I think about a lot.
No,
I mean, that's fair.
Yeah, it just kind of shows that you're natural at it, I guess.
I would argue with that, though, because like, something I'm finding is I don't consider myself much of a social butterfly. I kind of think very narrowly. It's hard for me, like I said, to think that any random thought I have is worth a conversation or like investigation or something like that, which is why Twitter just isn't really a very good fit for me. But the place this all really works out is on like close discourse platforms like Discord. I can go in and on a personal basis just have conversations with the people who are there, you know. So when I start thinking about like, ah, geez, these are fans and I need a way to engage them on social media and stuff, it's like daunting and awful. But when I think like, oh, like, here's something I'm like longing to talk about and here are people who want to talk about it, it becomes a lot easier. So I think the thing I'd say is like, learn to identify topics you want to talk about and then talk to the people who want to have the conversation.
Yeah, there you go. That's a better strategy than, I don't know, I post about lemon.
Well, that's what you did, though. Like, it was a valuable, interesting conversation. I don't know about value, but interesting conversation between you and your friend. And you were like, okay, well, obviously, this is a conversation worth having, so let's get other people to weigh in on it, you know? And I think if it's just like natural and honest like that, and you're not like trying to impress everybody on social media, I think you'll probably have maybe a better time.
So yeah, I do get nervous because I have people that are actually like famous following me on Twitter now, and I'm like, oh no, they're seeing it. The director of a famous DreamWorks franchise has seen me post about this.
That's awesome.
Oh, man, that's actually phenomenal.
So we're building in popular media, shall we?
Sure, most certainly.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess to get things started, speaking of your audiences and fans and such, is there any specific world or setting that you guys would like to talk about to your audience that you just haven't gotten a chance to yet, or the opportunity hasn't arisen? And if so, you know, why is it so enticing to do?
Tim, you take this.
Okay, so this is one of the big kind of changes that I've gone into this year. So while I haven't done it in the past, I am going to be. So I've sort of restricted my videos to kind of films, books, TV shows, that sort of thing, but I'm expanding it to games. There's a bunch of games and game narratives that I want to discuss. Like, I've got a big video on God of War coming out in a couple of weeks. When The Last of Us 2 comes out, I'm going to have a big long video of the first game, which I haven't even played yet, but I've bought. And I am also going to do an hour plus long video on my favorite game of all time, The Talos Principle. So these are some of the worlds that I really, really want to explore and stories that I want to explore. But I haven't had time to yet, because engaging with like game narrative is very different to engaging with conventional narrative, I find.
Yeah, it's a lot more time consuming.
Well, it's time consuming, but it's more so that it's a fundamentally different way that we engage with a story.
Yeah,
the player agency very much changes how we experience these things, as opposed to the other mediums where the story is largely dictated to you.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, so that's what I really want to be talking about coming this year, and I'm hoping to sort of like, you know, soldier through perhaps the initial phase of resistance and kind of be able to broaden my brand to discussing that sort of thing as well.
I'd be surprised if you found too much resistance. I mean, I don't know the YouTube audience super well, but you know, the games that you mentioned, I know, are known for their stories more than not. So, you know, I think that weaves in pretty well with your current suite of titles that you kind of reference.
I mean,
well, hopefully.
I think that you also have this difference between games and other forms of media. You know, Roger Ebert always purported that games weren't art, and there's arguments to be made for both sides, and he did in the end say that there were some games that were art. And I think that it's the interactivity with a game's story and world that changes how we view it so much from something like a novel or a movie, where it's the static thing and you can interpret it, but you can't interact with it.
Yeah, that's very much it. What about you, Benji?
In terms of like what worlds I would love to talk about that I haven't yet.
Yeah.
It's difficult because I'm accidentally a massive hipster, and like, I don't consume as much pop media as I could, which unfortunately has the effect of making me really weak in a lot of those conversations. But there are some worlds that I think are not as popular as they could be. Specifically, I don't know, like, how, if I reflected on it, I don't know how great I think the writing would be, but in Felix Gilman's The Half-Made World and the subsequent The Rise of Ransom City, that world building has possessed me. Like, I can't stop integrating pieces of it into my ideas and stuff. And I would love to talk about it because it has this strong basis in concept. And I don't know if the author intended for that or not, but a lot of world building I see is like, people will have this huge plethora of things they want to see in fiction, and they'll put it into their own work. That, or they'll have this top-down concept that they want to create with their world. But at some level, I think the world ultimately kind of boils down to lots of disparate features coming together to create a whole, where with Gilman's work, when you step back from it, the picture, it just like, it becomes more clear. Not when you step back from it, when you immerse yourself in it, the picture becomes more clear. It becomes more focused the further in you go, rather than being a wider network of disparate materials the deeper you look. So like, unlike Star Wars, where like at the outset you kind of get what it's about, but the deeper you go, the more extensive the lore becomes, and it goes far beyond anything to do with Jedi and Sith and stuff like that. With Gilman's world, there's this concept that the world has not finished being made yet, that there's still powers working on it way in the west on that frontier. And you don't even see that until late into the book. And that, I don't think that's a big spoiler. Characters talk about it. But there's these forces at play, these factions who want to shape the world desperately. And all of their nuances and stuff, it all plays together into this theme of what the world will be when you work upon it or when you exert your influence upon it. And like, it's beautiful. Like, I rarely see worlds that are so thematically sound throughout. So that's something I would love to talk about in more depth in like a video or something like that. It's also hard because I have to make money to survive. And if nobody knows the topic, it's kind of hard to sell as a YouTube video. So that's something I compete with. But someday I'll be popular enough that I can do whatever I want. And that's when I'll talk about this thing.
When you get to that influencer level.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. Ooh. We both, I think Tim and I have talked about how that word makes us cringe.
Yeah. It's not a nice term.
It is not. I totally agree.
It's so corporate.
So, what are some of your least favorite worlds?
Ooh.
Oh, that's mean.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's, yeah. We both, I think we both do pretty positive content about stuff that we love in writing for the most part. So we might be ill-equipped to answer.
Least favorite, I think, in this context doesn't mean that these worlds are bad in any way. It's just that they don't excite you for whatever reason.
Or they can be bad. Give me the juicy deets.
I think I could give you a rare take. But Tim, if you had something, go ahead.
No, I'll let you go first.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's all right. You know, here you go.
Okay, well, oh man, this is so difficult because like my usual parlance about this stuff is just that like, well, even if there's something out of place or something that's not working for me or something like that, there's this thing that works. But my least favorite in fiction in general, man, I would get a lot of flack. I probably would if I talked about this on the show, but like some of the world building in comic books, I guess.
Oh my god,
and that's that's so broad. I know, that's like so incredibly broad. But just like it's one of the reasons it's been difficult for me to pick up and like follow comic books, because so much of the world building is so, and like this is the total opposite of what I was just saying, but so thematically centered, so about these characters you care about and their impact on the world directly, that like if you don't get enfranchised in the character, if you're not invested in them, a lot of the time there's like, it feels like the rest of the world is kind of props for them to interact with. And I'm talking comic books. I specifically mean like some DC titles that I'll leave unnamed. But like, I think a lot of comic books are so like, so about theme, so about conveying theme and character arc and stuff like that, that the world ends up being much less important. And so I would say like just for the fact that like a lot of them are maybe a little didactic, they have a message they want to share or something like that, the world ends up being made for them to make that message in. Does that make sense?
No, it totally does.
I think in a lot of ways that when you're writing any work of fiction, the world is created to prop up the characters who you want to share. But I do agree, like, I think it didn't occur to me even that superhero stories and films and these various media types, it didn't occur to me that they even had world building until like a year ago when someone started talking about it. I'm like, oh yeah, I guess it does. And that kind of led me down a rabbit hole of like, well, why didn't I think about this in the first place? Like, why didn't it even occur to me? And I think it is like you're saying that it is so centered around this one character and their impact on the world that I think the offset of that is, you know, you often don't see the world's impact on them or the world impacting regular people. It's just not something that the genre really supports as well, I don't think.
I know that at least in my opinion, comic books break the like one rule I have for world building, which is be, you know, consistent. And they don't even try sometimes. And I think that just totally ruins the effect for me when it comes to their world building.
And they're super fun. Like some of my favorite films are these Marvel films that have come out. They're entertaining.
I'm so curious.
What's that?
Which ones? Which Marvel films are some of your favorite films?
I think that the Endgame films. I'm forgetting the actual name of the other one, but Infinity War and Endgame. Those were just super fun for me because I saw the lead up to them, and the films themselves are pretty good too. But like, I didn't leave the film and think like the world building was great. Like that was never even a thought in my head. It was all about the character journey and the action and the witty comments that were slung around. I guess when it comes to world building, it's just not something that I really think about in that genre, even though like I think that there's some interesting potential for it.
I would like, in my own defense, I'd like to make a quick caveat that like, I gotta say again, like comic books, massive. And some of the world building in a book like Hellboy or like Watchmen is incredible and like fascinating. So this is like, this is a take that has a metric ton of salt in the glass, far more than like a grain of salt. Take it with all the salt because I'm not well versed enough in comic books in general to have a very strong opinion. This is just more like an impression that I have based on what I've seen and kind of something that's kept me from getting more invested from the outside.
Ryan, I'm afraid you had a far more articulate answer than I'm going to have. So I'm so glad that you went first because now I can hype up my answer and be like, oh yeah, all of that, I echo those feelings. I was gonna say Marvel, the world building of the Marvel, they just doesn't excite me. There's gonna be so many dimensions to why that might be. It could be the characters, it could be the story, it could be the villains or the themes or whatever, or that it's just all very samey storytelling. But I don't know, those worlds, the Marvel world and the DC world really. At least in the movies that have been coming out, don't excite me. I feel there's more potential in the DC worlds at the moment because they're trying to do weirder things. But at the moment, those films just don't excite me. Their world building just doesn't excite me.
Tim, let's not like make a vow right now, but I've not encountered many other people that like really share this sentiment. So I would love like at some point to go through the like arduous process of figuring out like the appeal to the people who are invested and like learning appreciation for it with you. So like we could like make that pilgrimage together. I think it would be fun to join
your houses.
You got to remember that both Benji and I come from a perspective, at least I think this is a fair summary, that we like learning from positive examples and not negative examples. And we like to focus on the positive, which is why we don't tend to think that much about, or at least we don't intentionally go out of our way to frame our work in a way that's negative.
No, of course. That's why I wanted to ask it, just to see what the thought was underneath.
And I think it's important, just like learning from positive examples, I think it's important to learn from not negative examples, but examples which maybe they didn't quite hit the mark for whatever reason. With Marvel, since we're talking about it, I think part of the reason, especially for myself, why I like it is, like I said, because of the action, because of the witty banter, and you kind of get invested in these characters after however many years, what is it, like 10, 11 years that these things have been going on. And so like, that's why I'm interested. Like there was a point at a couple of years where the movies just weren't interesting me because the villains were kind of one-dimensional, and then it started kind of getting better a little bit. And, you know, at a certain point I'm already this far in, so I guess we're just going to keep going. But like, that's, I think, why the world building there doesn't interest me as much, is because I'm there for other things. I'm not there to learn about the world. It's kind of like a break from world building in a way.
And never forget, you can look at something that has not that great world building, learn a lot from it. Mistakes are some of the most potent lessons. And on top of that, I mean, our example is Harry Potter. It has some of the worst world building you'll ever see, but it's still the most successful book series of all time. And God, I love it. I love Harry Potter, and it's horrible.
Actually, Harry Potter is actually another one of those examples that I referred to before, is that realistic world building is not necessarily good world building. Because Harry Potter's not realistic, but it's incredibly immersive.
And it's not, it's interesting because it's also not necessarily logically consistent throughout, but that doesn't diminish the effect. Because like that sense of wonder and new exploration is, yeah. And it's one of the weird things about the later books, man. I would love to talk about this on the show at some point. I just have no idea how to even approach it. But that's a totally different tangent. The thing about the world building in Harry Potter is that it like from square one, you are given an excuse to explore like chocolate frogs and people who speak to snakes and spells that are essentially like Latin language firecrackers that like there's no articulate logic within the stories themselves as to why or how the spells work. And I don't think you really care when you're reading the stories. It's not what they're about.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
For that, world building is totally serviceable.
And especially starting the story out with those elements and showing us these fantastical things that make no sense, but you want to learn more about, like that is a great way to introduce a magical world because you know there are so many possibilities and you want to explore what those are.
And it breaks the first rule and it's still great. It's inconsistent at times, but that's part of the charm. And I think looking at what things do wrong and what things do right are equally important.
Oh, go ahead, Tim.
No, I didn't have anything to say. You go ahead.
Okay. Well, I have strong feelings about this because one of the reasons I feel so compelled to make positive or find like what works well in stories and fiction and media instead of finding what doesn't work is one, because I think it's more conducive to the creation of good work. You could know everything you could do wrong and you still wouldn't know how to write a good story. You would just know what not to do. So I think ultimately, I think it is more important. It's not without value, the like knowing where not to go or what not to do, what to avoid. There's definitely value in that. But I think ultimately, for the purposes of creation, knowing what to do and what you can do and what tools are available to you is more useful overall. But the bigger thing is that I think there's kind of a sense of fear that's from seeing failure, like this Schadenfreude or I don't know, like something similar to that, where you see someone tear apart a movie that you thought was good and you go, oh man, I'm so wrong. Like, can I even write? Like, what if I write something and someone tears it apart like that? Like, is it even worth trying? It's scary. So I kind of think like that there is a really maybe negative impact that this compulsive negative response to media people seem to have on social media might have on new writers. Just terrified, you know, and I have nothing to back this up. It's just something I feel from time to time when I see these like massive amounts of fans lashing back so passionately for something the author like had no idea they were doing wrong.
Yeah, it always sucks to see something that you enjoy be dragged in the mud a little bit. One thing I will say about positive and negative feedback information, I think that the benefit of the positive reinforcements and information, like what you guys do on your channels and through your content, is you can use it on its own and you can learn from it on its own. Whereas I think with examples that don't work as well, that's very helpful, but I think only in tandem with the aspect of what does work well. So you get both sides and that's helpful. But when you only get the negatives, then it's probably too harmful, I think, psychologically as someone who's trying to make content. Like, you get trapped in this idea of, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. So it only works, I think, when it only works well, I think, when taken alongside information that is positive.
Yeah, I think I just thought of the way I would want to explain this if I had been thinking about this ahead of time. And that would be like, if someone gave you a map that just told you where not to go, you would never get to your destination. You know, like,
be very hard to, at least, and take a lot of pluck, luck, and, well, more luck. Okay. But no, I fully agree, Adam. Like, if you're only hearing what's bad,
yeah,
then you're not going to reaffirm any positive, like, skills or beliefs or talents.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you, like, to close it off, I think you need to learn things to do, not just things not to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where I'm at.
All right. Well, I guess from here we will close out. Any closing statements that you guys have? Any last bits of tidbits? Any last information you'd like to share?
Oh, thank you for having us on.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. I liked all the tangents. I liked the part where Tim gave me some guff for hypocritically criticizing his robot voice. But it is a ton of fun. It's very cathartic in a weird way to be able to talk about some of this stuff that, like, I think about quietly to myself on a daily basis. And I think that's, like, do you feel that too, Tim? Like, that freedom to, like, talk about these weird occupational things you experience?
It's very cathartic because these jobs are they're very lonely in a sense. You're not surrounded by people who do what you do. So when you find a community of people who do, it's very... It's nice to be able to talk about those sort of occupational difficulties.
Well, I'm glad that I've been able to give you guys that platform, and Adam was able to ring you both here at the same time by total accident and happenstance.
Yeah, you gave it Tim and I another opportunity to get to know each other.
And here I thought you two knew each other well.
I'll see you on the next live stream.
Yeah, we'll do.
But yeah, it's been great having you guys. If you ever want to come back, we'll be here.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you, gentlemen.
And yeah, absolutely.
Have a good night.
You've been tuned into Worldcasting, an affiliate production of Worldbuilding Magazine. Have any feedback, comments, questions, or concerns? You can get in touch with us on our website, worldbuildingmagazine.com. There you can find links to our social media. Or feel free to come chat with us on the Worldbuilding Magazine Discord server. Thanks for listening to Worldcasting, and until next week, keep worldbuilding.